Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell, and I'm sitting here with Rob O'Hearn, and we're across. No, it's just going to get my breath here. One of the best interviewers ever, Kerry O'Brien, is coming to talk about a memoir, which is his latest book. Now, I read and then shared it with Rob, some rules about how to do a good interview by you. And we realised we didn't hit any of those rules. We didn't get in. So forgive us if we don't do the best interview on the best interviewer.
Well, you probably... there are some basics, but everybody has their own style.
Excellent, because we have none. And we'll call that a style by the end of it.
Just you have a style that you're not aware of.
It's a grungy street style.
Grungy street style, love it. Kerry, we've both been reading your book. It's a big book. There's a lot of life in there, and I don't think our podcast is even going to get... scratch the surface of this, which is why it's good to get a book to go and read. Where do you start? Do you start at the beginning like David Copperfield, or do we go and jump straight into you reporting on Granada, or do we talk about your interviews with Mandela? What are the things that stand out for you? I know you just spent a lot of time writing about the whole thing, but when you look at it as a life lived well, as I reckon it is, what are the things that stand out most for you? What are the moments in there?
Oh, look, in terms of my work as a journalist, there are milestones. The early years, I think, when I look back, are marked by the extraordinary difference in the available technology there for broadcasting, for television, compared to today. And almost decade by decade from the 60s when I started, 1966... through to when I hung up my spurs at 7:30, there were big milestone moments, and I suppose the biggest of them all was the satellite and the digital transformation. Mm. And in some ways, it gave journalists far greater scope for the kind of instant hit of journalism, reporting coups as they happened around the world, actually changing the course of history. As I think to a degree happened with the coup attempt by the Russian old guard against Gorbachev in the early 90s. Those things to me, great breakthroughs in one sense, but there is a downside, and the downside I think is that part of the fallout from that is that a lot of news today is more superficial, strangely enough. Mm. So we have faster access, but in some ways less depth.
You talk about that in the book, where you talk about the emergence of the 24-hour news cycle in the US, where when you were there, you started to see this sort of emerging, and it kind of had a hint of, you know, what might be coming in the future. Now we're in the future, and it's probably worse than you ever sort of thought.
Well, in some ways it is.
Yeah.
You know, in some ways it is. And particularly in commercial television, where infotainment is now almost the order of the day. I would not want to knock those journalists who are still serious about their craft in commercial television, and they are, you know, and there are those people. But they are fighting against a culture which is almost desperate to pull its ratings in at the expense of just about everything else, which is why public broadcasting becomes that much more important. But public broadcasting itself is under its own strains, and so that is just one part of an enormous challenge, really. If we value our democracy, then we should value quality journalism, and there is a lot to be concerned about.
Yeah, within the book you talk about the undermining of that way back in the Fraser years, and sort of the concerns that they were chipping away at the independence of the ABC even back then. But you've had, within your career, you've been on both sides, and you've been in and out of the commercial side and the ABC.
Well, I started. I got my start in journalism in a very small then television newsroom at Channel 9 in Brisbane. Gave me my start in journalism. At another point, I worked at the 7 Network. The 7 Network allowed me to launder myself back into mainstream journalism after I had besmirched my reputation by daring to go and work for Gough Whitlam. And the ABC at that point wouldn't have me back.
Yep.
And through the Seven Network, I had a wonderful 2-year experience as a correspondent in the United States. I was able to do a fantastic 90-minute documentary that got me a Gold Walkley at the Seven Network. So it was still possible, and is still possible today, to exercise quality journalism in the commercial sphere, but it was hard then, and it's harder now.
Well, for one period, you were living with George Negus, who was doing 60 Minutes at the time.
That didn't have much to do with journalism, John.
But he was considered at that time, yeah, a serious journalist. 60 Minutes was a serious vehicle for investigative.
He was a 60 Minutes original, and he brought the same quality to his work at 60 Minutes as he had at the ABC. And that was a time when 60 Minutes was serious about its journalism. Ray Martin was an excellent journalist who was committed to his craft. Ian Leslie. It's all part of the passing landscape.
Mm. One of the things I enjoyed about the book is the camaraderie between journalists, particularly people giving a helping hand to aspiring journalists.
Yeah.
And here's what you got to do. Don't worry about that and all that. It's really refreshing. Do you think that's been lost, or is that still strong?
Oh, I think, look, this was particularly true. I mean, I always had mentors, you know, from the very start. I had a wonderful guy named Charlie McCarthy, who was a salt of the earth journo who had been, I think, he'd been air crew in the Second World War. He'd been a print journo on now defunct newspapers like the Argus in Melbourne, and he was a wonderful role model for me early on. And I managed to find somebody like that at practically every one of my early jobs through journalism. That was really important to me. But when I first went to that groundbreaking ABC program, This Day Tonight, which was the forerunner of what 7:30 is today,
yeah.
And that had started in late 67, and I joined them in early 1972. And they were a wonderful bunch of human beings as well as great journalists. And the atmosphere then there was very collegiate. People helped each other. And we each had those amongst us that we absolutely respected and at times were influenced by. It was a wonderful culture to be a part of. And there was a great spirit of competitiveness, but there was nothing malicious or negative about it. You know, it had its place. And we had some great lunches in those days. There was certainly a lunch culture in journalism in those days. But do you know what? In the passing of that culture, yes, I suppose that meant in part that journalists, from the employer's perspective, may spend more time formally on the job. But do you know what's lost? When we were having those lunches, or if we'd go for a drink after work, all we talked about was journalism. All we talked about was the stories, the personalities, the analysis. We lived and breathed it, and that fed back into our work. But it was a wonderful environment to be in. And when I went to Four Corners the first time in 75, it was the same. I was the kid, you know. I was barely 30 when I went to Four Corners, and there were some quite august older journalists there. Carolyn Jones was the anchor. Some wonderful other older experienced journalists who, again, I learned from. And I felt safe in that environment, that I could trust the people around me. And if they gave me advice, I listened.
There's a crossover after that point where you do take that job with Gough. And, you know, it's been interesting to see your perspective, because the Gough myth has just gone bigger and bigger and bigger. And the way you describe him in the book, he wins you over in one moment there. And he reaches out and does the Gough thing, I think, on you. And I don't blame you for sort of falling into that and wanting to be aligned. But you do keep your distance, and you are able to, keep your own self in that role. But it must have been a very hard time. It was like the worst opportunity to be with Gough in that
the worst time.
The worst time to be with Gough in that period.
Except, John, look, maybe a part of me wished that I had been a part of it when they were in government, because power is a fascinating process being wielded within a government, particularly if it's somebody you respect who's doing the wielding. But I don't regret for one minute the time I spent and what that experience represented to me. And yes, I did retain a kind of objectivity, but I also got close to Gough. And I mean, father-son relationship is a bit kind of a bit cliched, but I felt we had a connection, and the fact that he was no longer Prime Minister didn't mean that he ceased to be a fascinating character or an important figure of Australian political history.
Yeah.
And I had some wonderful conversations with him, and of course his grasp of history was profound. And one of the motivating forces for me in writing this book is that I know so few people these days who have even the interest to go back into our history, let alone the grasp of it. And I think there are a lot of journalists today who don't have anything like the grasp of history that they should, including some of our political journalists. Mm. I think it's absolutely paramount to know the past, to understand the present, and to try and peer into the future.
And you say in that that even in his last few years, he was still going through Hansard and sending off questions for the MPs to ask.
Absolutely. Absolutely he was. And, you know, when I travelled with him, and I travelled very intensely with him because I knew when I joined that we were not far off an election, and the wise heads in the office said, you better spend a lot of time with him and get to know each other, because it is going to be an incredibly intense period during election campaign. So I was with him 7 days a week, basically, long hours. And every time we would finish a parliamentary session and he'd climb on a plane, the minute his bum hit the seat, out would come the weekly Hansard. And he would be writing, he'd be flicking through, and he would be writing his own index to the Hansard on the front. And then we'd get back to the office and it would be filed. And so, you know, even in his last years, he had that enormous bank of Hansards and the memory to go with it.
Yeah. Well, in my family, Gough is a god, and always was. And because I grew up, I was born in 72, so the sort of as I grew up, there was this constant reference to him. And my father and my sister were heavily involved in the Labor Party, and so you know it sort of comes in. Having had that experience with a great man, 24/7 for a period there, did that help you or hinder you or make the brushes with great people later in your career easier to deal with? Or did you want more? Like you got a little taste of Mandela. Could I hang out with you for a couple of weeks?
Look, what it allowed me to do was to see the democratic process from the inside in a very intimate way. So I was able to see those politicians that otherwise as a journalist I would have only known from the outside. I was able to see what made them tick. I was able to come to understand their motivation, see the flaws, see the good points, see the beginning and end of cynicism, watching the struggle, the classic struggle of democracy, which is the struggle with compromise, which is an inevitable part of a democracy. It's okay to try to be a purist, but a successful, good politician cannot be a purist forever. Compromise is an absolutely fundamental part of any successful democracy.
And do you think the things, when they don't have to compromise, things go worse?
The other end of compromise is zealotry.
Yeah. When work choices came in, it wasn't a great political move, but he had so much power. Like he had both houses and, well, why wouldn't you?
So John Howard learnt the hard way.
Yeah.
That, I mean, he was very big on saying that he would not be a Prime Minister displaying hubris. But that was John Howard's moment of hubris when he decided to go for broke with work choices because he had the majority of both houses. And that came at a great political cost. Look, there was no negative for me in working with Whitlam, and I was able to watch some of the formative years of people like Paul Keating.
Mm.
And So it gives you an extra edge, I think, of perspective and perception. It helps you sharpen your perceptions.
Yeah.
But then when I walked away from it, I had no trouble being able to stand back from that. And in fact, there were a few friendships that I made with politicians in that period when I was inside, working on the inside. And I have to say, in several cases, it was to their cost, because there were moments when I would approach a politician for an interview with whom I had a friendship of sorts, and knowing that they were so, I mean, I wasn't cynically using the friendship, but it was an approach that I was going to have to make as a journalist, and I would watch them struggle with their decision and say yes as an acknowledgement to me, when in fact they probably should have said no, and then cop a bit of a caning in the interview, which they knew they were going to get.
Yeah.
So it is entirely possible to have been aligned with one side of politics on a professional basis as a press secretary or speechwriter or whatever, but then go back into journalism and put on your professional journalist cloak again. Mm. And it's why, I've said it in the book, that, God, I swore I wouldn't say that, it's in the book. but I've said in the book that, and I've named a number of ABC journalists who have worked on, they've worked for Labor politicians, they've worked for Liberal politicians, they've worked for National Party politicians. The only important thing to me in that, when they come back to their journalism, is that they are scrupulous in their professionalism as independent journalists. And that's the basis you judge them on. You don't judge them because they worked for John Howard or they worked for Gough Whitlam or they worked for Malcolm Fraser or whoever. You judge them on their work.
Mm. Well, you've won two Walkleys for your interviews, and you're famous for your interviews. And there have been people who have been completely and utterly undone with you looking over your glasses like you're doing at us right now.
We started undone.
Yeah, we were undone from a word go.
We were never done.
Yeah. No, in the quote we were referring to at the beginning was a lot to do with research and understanding the other person's perspective and why they're coming at it from the angle they're coming from. Sometimes it felt like lambs to the slaughter. Sometimes there was more of a battle going on. The interview you did with Thatcher seems like more of an even-handed battle that wasn't won by either. Mm. What were the ones you liked most? Like, was it that kind of interview where you got someone who's really, really strong across from
well,
you?
Well, look, I was never big on the so-called gotcha moment. I don't think I ever, I think I'm being honest here, I don't think I ever went into an interview looking for a gotcha moment. And, in fact, my primary purpose in doing current affairs interviews was not to kind of break news. If you broke news along the way, fine. But primarily, as far as I was concerned, it was about, some interviews just were going to break news simply because you happened to get the interview with John Howard or Paul Keating immediately after a big event, and so of course every word they say instantly becomes news. I don't regard those as moments of great credit, but the primary focus for the kinds of interviews that I was doing on 7:30 were about trying to get behind the basic issues and the basic news of the issues we were talking about to bring a greater understanding to what they were about, a greater understanding of the motives behind the, let's say it's a policy decision, behind the policy decision. If there were issues of criticism about the way something was being done, then it was about testing. So it was about testing the politician, but it was also about shedding light on the issues so people could understand them better. And really, it's about, good journalism is primarily about enlightenment. To me, it's about informing and enlightening, and of course there are things that deserve to be exposed, which are unhealthy or bad or crooked and corrupt or abuses of power. Incredibly important that those are a fundamental part of the bag of tricks that journalists carry around. But it is primarily about informing and enlightening, as far as I'm concerned. And if I could do an interview and walked away from it feeling I'd done that, I was happy. I might add, I wasn't always happy. I wasn't often happy. There was always something that would bug me.
You've also don't use the same approach with cultural heroes and pop stars and celebrities, and there's a whole chapter on that in the book. Do you have any, I'm talking to these people moments, or do you have... Is there a sense that these people are as strong as the politicians?
You know, the only person that I ever really felt an enormous privilege to be there with was Mandela, really, the only one, because he was such an exceptional figure, such an exceptional leader. I think probably the outstanding leader of my lifetime, certainly. I don't think there's an argument there. And really, I was, I think, so driven by curiosity. I just saw each of these interviews as an opportunity. The Thatcher interview that you talk about, the one where she walked out, that was when she visited Australia in 88. And I was working for commercial television then. I was working for the Ten Network, and it was a program called Page One. Terrible title. she was sort of... It was. It gave me an idea of what it would have been like to interview the Queen.
Right.
In the sense that she saw herself as a majesty, I'm sure. She spoke at times in the third person or in the royal plural. She had this incredible haughtiness about her. She sort of looked down her nose and was terribly conscious of herself. And really, when you're interviewing a visiting dignitary, I don't believe you have the same scope for the take no prisoners approach that we often apply to Australian politicians, and Australians expect that. So it's a little softer in a way. Yet there were two big issues that I felt had to be explored with her, and one was the north-south divide between North England and South England with the reforms that she was pushing through in a far more brutal way than were pushed through in Australia, where the South was prospering and the North was struggling in poverty, and she was just in denial about it. So she didn't like that one. And then the other part, of course, was the Zulu chief Buthelezi in South Africa, who was essentially hand in glove with the apartheid regime. And he was her favourite black person in South Africa. And she made claims about him and his popularity that were simply untrue, and I called her out on that, and that was the point she decided to walk out. Now, I was happy to do that interview, but you know the amazing thing about it? I've still got them. I've got over 100 letters from people in England who wrote to me, who took the trouble. This is not like dashing off a quick email these days. They sat down and wrote to this stranger on the other side of the world to thank me for having asked her the questions that English journalists were not asking her. And that was a real eye-opener to me. And in fact, there were some serious journalists in England who made that precise point, who were calling out their own for their failures to hold the Thatcher government to account. And that was one of our soft interviews. By Australian standards, that was a soft interview.
Yeah, that's what I was about to ask. Is Australians, we have a different approach to interviewing as opposed to foreign journalists?
Not completely, and it's not like, you know, I mean, there are some excellent, I mean, Jeremy Paxman didn't exactly hold back.
Yeah, that's true.
But this was different era, different leader. Thatcher had them bluffed. But there is, I mean, you know, the bear pit of Australian politics, the Parliament, is a pretty tough place by comparison with some of the other kind of houses of democracy around the world. And I think some of that is also true for our journalism.
Kerry, thank you so much for coming in and joining us. This is a big book, and it is so full of wonderful history, your personal life, but you know, it just opens up, I think, for a generation of people who have, as you said, there are people who aren't reading the history. This is a nice way of getting history into their diet via the form of memoir, because you sneak in a lot of history into this book. The writing is exceptional. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Rob.
And you can get hold of Kerry's memoir at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.